This is WFAE Talks. I'm Greg Collard, news director at WFAE. We have education reporter Lisa Miller, and back with us, energy and environment reporter Brad.
Wow. Thank you.
You know what? We're going to leave that.
We're going to leave that.
My name is Ben Bradford.
Ben Bradford.
And everybody,
at least he didn't call you Lisa.
Listen. Or every day that I live my life, somebody mistakes my name for Brad. And I'd like to talk to somebody who studies, something about names, something like that, because I would like to find out what it is about it, whether it's the alliteration or whether it's the last name is also a first name thing or what.
Like, it's
why
that.
This happens.
It is that.
It's just like
you don't need
Brad
a study.
Ben and Brad. I think that's the first time I've ever done that, though.
Probably. But I'm just saying, I get emails that say, it's not just like the hearing thing. I get emails that say, oh, hi, Brad. Who was it yesterday? 2 days ago, I was doing something. Oh, Mike Collins called me Brad on the air the other day. Yeah.
Really?
On Wednesday. Yes. Yes. So, I mean, yeah, it happens all the time.
Did you correct him?
So I'm glad we've got this on there. No, I didn't correct him because it was, we had a lot more, it's less flexible than this format.
Okay. All right. Well, good to have you back. You were gone last week because you were tired from working a lot and being up north covering the Dan River spill and all that.
I thought you just wanted to introduce everybody to Tom. I was ready to go. Yeah. I don't sleep. Anybody listening? I don't sleep.
Okay.
Just work.
All right. Lisa, did you enjoy the snow this week?
I loved the snow this week.
Did you really?
Oh, yeah. I absolutely did. On a Wednesday, I did not come in to have a person posted close to Uptown. So I did venture out and took a peek at the closed outbound Independence and talked to a bunch of sledders. And Thursday, I did come in, and that was a little dicier than I expected. But I still really enjoyed the snow and the cocoon of everything being shut down during that time and people just having to make do.
Ben, did you enjoy it?
I hate snow.
You do?
I'm Californian. I don't know. Snow is something you go to. Snow is not something that happens to you, and it's certainly not something I'm supposed to be driving in. I learned some things about how all that works, but no, like I did not like going outside and going out to report. Same thing, going out to report in the snow. I did this thing yesterday where I went out to these warming centers, where the homeless are essentially spots for the homeless to keep warm, mm-hmm. and. Before I could do that, I was like, all right, I'm going to check this thing out. Opened up my door, was like, okay, my stairs have turned into a slide. And then I had to dig myself down and then go back up, put the shovel back away. And
you actually have a shovel.
I do. I have a shovel because I lived in Washington, D.C. for a couple of years. And I was using a dustpan to clean off my stairs there. And one of my cousins took pity on me and just gave me a shovel. And it's been riding around. Luckily, it's been riding around my car for 3 years.
I'm glad.
But sure, I mean, the snow certainly makes it tough for a lot of people. And your piece this morning about all the folks in the warming centers who were then taken to shelters. I mean, it certainly makes it clear.
And it's, it's tough for, all the way around. You think about it, you think about on both sides of it, right? In that particular situation, you've got, first of all, the homeless themselves, the homeless people who have to... Who do get shuffled from one place to another, right? They don't go to the shelters until nighttime. So in this case, where do they go during the day? So the Red Cross opens up a warming mm-hmm. center. They only have two volunteers who are, they had 250 people over the lifetime, for the 3 day lifetime of this warming center.
That's amazing. There's two volunteers to manage all that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you have the people themselves who are, get a lot of them with mental health problems or other kinds of issues. And they have to go and figure out, okay, where can I go tonight? And there is a lot of shuffling there. So that's very difficult. But on the other side of it, like you just said, you've got volunteers who, what could be more noble than to be volunteering in this kind of a storm for people who have so little. And you've got, two of them that are running this thing. But you think about it, and it's hard on both sides. So then also there was one of the shelters. The urban ministry runs a shelter service, but actually they rely on local churches to give beds. But staff couldn't get into the churches, so now all of a sudden this shelter has less beds the transportation people couldn't get that were going to transport the people to the shelters couldn't get the buses out of the parking lot because there was an icy hill it had to go up to. The buses couldn't make it up. So all of a sudden, these people have no transportation. And then, you know, I think that it applies to both sides. You know, you've got the everybody's trapped by the snow, and at the same time, services need to increase for mm-hmm. it. And there's this kind of push pull that happens that's pretty tough all the way around.
I tried to talk to a snowplow driver yesterday. It was around 10 in the morning, and he would not talk to me on tape, but he said very kindly, "Look, I've been up for 36 hours plowing the streets, and I'm going to go back home." It was snowing a lot at that time. He's like, there's not much we can do at this point. I'm going to go back home, get a little bit of sleep, and maybe snowmobile with my son, and then come back here in a couple hours. And then one of the guys who was shoveling, he said, he'll talk to you. And he agreed. He'd talk to me. And then he said, "I just have to put something into my truck." And then the next thing I see, the truck pulling away.
And he's driving off.
So, yeah, I mean, certainly this snowstorm made it tough for a lot of people who couldn't just, who didn't either have a home or couldn't stay inside. So
it was a really interesting story you had, Ben. And you think most of them did find a shelter? I know
no.
you talked to some who
no,
actually were going somewhere
I
else.
Think that...
To a parking deck or something.
You know, it's an issue that I have to look into more and I've been meaning to for a while. And it's more complicated than I can probably do justice to right now. But from my brief amount of time, just from yesterday talking to all the various people involved, first of all, many of them were not going to the shelters. And whether because there's something they don't like about the shelters or they've been kicked out because of behavioral mm-hmm. Problems at the shelters. You know, I ran into the first person I talked to who's actually the last person in that story, but he was going to a parking deck. And he said it was because the urban ministry, he was sure wouldn't have room. They do women and children first and the men get beds last. And he was sure that at that point, I think they had 64 slots and it was about noon. And he said, all right, well, you know, by the time 4 o'clock or 4:30, which is I think the cutoff comes, they're not going to have any spots, so I'm going to a parking deck. And, you know, that's just crushing.
Did he have any warm, cold weather gear with him? Any?
Not really. I mean, he was
much
wearing
of a jacket or sweaters.
He was not wearing particularly warm clothing. And, I mean, my recollection of him, I know that the next person I talked to had just a sweatshirt on, and I mentioned that in the story as well. And my recollection is that this man did not have much more than that. That is probably the single... like most depressing experience that I've ever had reporting is this man talking to me just very quietly and very matter-of-factly. I'm going to a parking deck.
Did you ever get an understanding? I mean, I know they're set up for the real short term, but why they had to close then?
Okay, so there are two things. First of all, they said that they kept it open longer than they intended to. Like I said, it's usually for the day, but they had kept it open 24/7. 24. They kept it up through Tuesday and through Wednesday and then closed Thursday at noon. And they said that they did that so that people would have a place to go. One of the volunteers who was there told me that the Red Cross's first priority is not the warming centers, it's setting up these shelters. And, you know, I only have the volunteer's word to go mm-hmm. off on this, but she said that essentially the most important thing for them was setting up these shelters. And shelters in this case are meaning for like people who lose power in, you know, an apartment building that loses power and people don't have heat, so they need to go out.
Well, in a few minutes, we're going to talk a little bit more about some interesting developments in the Dan River spill concerning the Department of Natural Resources and a federal investigation underway. But first, I want to talk a little bit more about the snow. What'd y'all think about how Charlotte was in the news nationally, how we were portrayed?
I didn't see a ton of it. I heard, you know, Ron Carley was talking to Robert Siegel on All Things Considered.
Yeah,
our city manager. But I don't know. Why don't you tell us what you, I mean, you obviously saw some of it. What did you say?
It's not so much that I saw it, but I got calls from family members saying, it looks like all your roads are shut down right now.
Right.
What are you doing? And I said, well, I'm going into work today. I think it's not as bad as it looks.
And Ron Carley was on All Things Considered talking to Robert Siegel about this. Let's hear from him right now.
It was amazing watching Charlotte on national TV. There was one relatively small stretch of one road that got really slippery, and we had to close down and get some 18-wheelers off and some cars that got stuck in order to treat the road and open it back up. And you would have thought the whole city was in gridlock. But that certainly was not the case. We had delays at a variety of different places. It was a little bit more pronounced on Independence Avenue yesterday, but that event lasted 2.5 hours.
Yet that's what everyone saw across the country with the cable networks and everything. And it occurred to me how the media was covering us nationally when we were actually filing some weather spots. Michael Tomczyk was with the NPR newscast unit, and they were trying to – they wanted to strengthen the language a little bit.
They wanted him to beef it up.
Yeah.
Because there's all kinds of problems out here and whatever.
Right. Yeah. And a friend of mine who works at NPR said, I understand that you all are the new Atlanta. It's just like Atlanta from a couple weeks ago.
Oh, man.
Nothing close to that. They're like Mr. Carley said, there were certainly some delays and some problems like you would have, but nothing like how they were – it wasn't even close to what they were seeing on TV.
I'd love to go back and like trace the evolution of that, you know, what – how that was spun from a local news story about Independence Boulevard into, oh, Charlotte has gridlock, and do whatever sort of national outlet, and then other outlets pick it up and just watch that, pun absolutely intended, snowball.
I feel like Raleigh may have played some part in that, because Raleigh, you know, the interstates
were
the streets were a lot worse. And so, you know, North Carolina people think Charlotte, Raleigh, They all got kind of hit the same. So
the email from NPR I had was exactly, you know, they were specific about Charlotte is the new Atlanta for this storm.
Did you tell them off?
I did not tell them off.
Mm. Missed opportunity.
What makes you think I would do that?
Well, I just think that, you know, in general, if there's sort of the sensationalism, maybe tell them off isn't quite the right word, but maybe to correct them and say,
am I known to do that?
Well, Greg, I feel like, yes, first of all, yes, you are known to do that. And second of all, if you're not going to do it, who is?
That's a good question. I do feel obligated to do that sometimes. And I'm not sure if everyone is always receptive to me doing that. But
you didn't let that slide, though, that Charlotte is the new Atlanta.
You let it slide.
I did not let it slide. I promptly responded in an email.
Okay. All right. That's all I was asking. All right.
But it was professional.
So you told him off.
Right. Well, let's move on. Really interesting development concerning the Dan River spill. The Department of Natural Resources is under investigation by the U.S. Attorney's Office. Ben, you've been following this?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So it happened yesterday while I was out in the snow that we got word. A few news outlets had gotten a subpoena from the Department of Environment and Natural Resources, or DENR.
They obtained
a public records request, right, to get this subpoena, and then you know we also got it. We also did a public records request and got a copy of it. And essentially, we don't know a ton. There's just it's very short, but it is asking the state regulators for information about for the conversations with Duke Energy and documents with involving Duke Energy after this coal ash spill. And just to recap, so people know what we're talking about, essentially a little over 12 days ago now, February 2nd, a stormwater pipe broke in this coal ash pond. And coal ash is the byproduct of burnt coal, and there's a power plant that sits on the Dan River in Eden, North Carolina, right on the border of North Carolina and Virginia. And the stormwater pipe broke, and this ash pond, which is water and ash that holds this waste, started leaking into the stormwater pipe and into the river. And the latest estimate is that somewhere between 30 and almost 40,000 tons of ash spilled into the river, and it contains all kinds of heavy metals, you know, arsenic, lead, selenium, chromium, boron, a lot of other
all bad stuff.
In large amounts, all not good. So now there's a subpoena, and basically they're asking state regulators for information about what happened right after it. And we don't know a lot more than that. We know that Duke also got a subpoena, but it certainly suggests they're looking at the relationship between Duke and state regulators after the spill, and what kind of role the regulators played, and looking at, you know, did they do their job? And
there's a lot of suspicion that Diener doesn't really do a good job.
Diener's been under scrutiny for a number of things. I mean, first of all, they severely cut back the amount of staff in their kind of water division. They used to have two divisions, water resources, and which kind of managed the water bodies, then water quality, which regulated them and tested the water and those kind of things. And they combined them all into water resources. So they don't have a division of water quality anymore. And that also came with a fairly substantial layoff of staff as they did that. So that was one. In addition to that, the administration, the secretary of the department, his message has been one of what he calls customer service. And what he means by customers, he's talking about both the public and he's talking about the utilities and various companies and corporations that they work with. And so the accusation from environmental organizations has been that they're more less concerned with regulating and making sure that and protecting public health, and more concerned with economic development and helping these corporations and so forth do their thing. So when you take sort of that context, in addition to the subpoena, it adds a little bit of complexity.
And it doesn't help that Governor McCrory actually spent most of his career with Duke Energy.
I'm glad you mentioned that. That's right. There's very close ties between Duke Energy and the administration. Obviously, that's right. McCrory was there. Sharon Decker, who's the Secretary of Commerce, is a former Duke employee. A lot of the Democratic organizations, the ones affiliated with the Democratic Party or liberal organizations in the state, have been pointing out the very large amount of campaign contributions that have gone to McCrory from Duke and so forth.
Now, the state has actually sued Duke over coal ash and how it keeps its ponds over here. And I know that there's some kind of discussion about sort of why they did that.
Right. That's exactly. Yeah, that's a really good point. The state announced last year that it was going to sue Duke at these various spots. But you would think that, you know, the usual thought is that, okay, a lawsuit they're going to get these guys. Environmental organizations don't look at it that way.
Because they had already filed intention to sue.
That's right. They'd said
and one
sue.
Of those suits in South Carolina really led to SCNG having to clean up those coal ash.
The Southern Environmental Law Center, which is exactly what it sounds like, brought a suit against SCENG, which is one of the South Carolina utilities, for its coal ash ponds. And ultimately, the two settled, and SCENG is now cleaning up its ash ponds along the rivers. So I think the environmental groups say that they could have maybe forced something similar.
And the state action actually wipes out their intent to sue.
And what happened is the Clean Water Act requires that organizations, before they sue, that they give notice of their intent to do it, and then regulators have time to come in and address those. So then the state came in instead and said it was suing. And if you look at the timeline,
which Governor McCrory points out,
that's right. So the state says, "Hey, we are the first guys to ever sue about this in any state." And then on the other hand, environmental organizations say, "Well, hey, we were going to sue," and then the state came in and sued, and then very quickly settled, and they came up with this settlement that requires years of study and just a slap on the wrist kind of fine. You know, for a multi-billion-dollar company, they're requiring Duke in the proposed settlement to pay less than $100,000. So that's the so people say that they're shielding Duke. Now, the state has, after the Dan River coal ash spill, they've pulled that settlement, and they say, well, they're reevaluating what it is that they want to do.
Interesting. Well, speaking of that and the spill, it was initially estimated 50,000 to 82,000 tons of coal ash spilled, and that was according to Duke. And then they said they were going to get the revised estimates to us, and it took a while, a little bit longer than expected to get those numbers, but now they're saying there wasn't as much as what they initially said was less than 40,000.
Right, 40, yeah, the estimate is essentially, at the top end, it's half of what the previous top-end estimate was, from 82,000 to less than 40,000. So, I mean, obviously that's still a lot.
So that's about 35 Olympic-sized swimming pools.
Is that right?
I think we were doing a calculation last week. I think 72 was...
73 was the oft-repeated that you saw in all the stories, 73 Olympic. I don't know who. Someone wrote it first, and then a lot of reporters.
Gotcha. I didn't do my own particular swimming pool calculations for whatever reason.
We don't trust your math that much.
I know. I appreciate that. I think we should measure more things in swimming pools. So, for instance, going back to the winter storm, the airport had 20,000 gallons of de-icing fluid shipped in on Wednesday. How many swimming pools is that?
I have no idea.
Okay, you got to have your have one of your kids figure it out for a math assignment.
Okay. All right, guys. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Greg's dancing. Are we off?
No, I'm not.